Hello, and joining you on January the 28th, a date celebrated according to some sources in some countries as National Have Fun at Work Day, but not, I can assure you, observed by this organisation. My name is Daniel Freeman, and I will be the poker-faced host of this episode of the Cycling Podcast, in which we'll joylessly recap the last week in professional cycling and glumly contemplate what's to come. The perfect man to assist me in that endeavour is Lionel Byrne. Lionel, I'm joking.
Dear me.
We will be having fun. We'll be having lots of fun. Lionel.
Well, I'm talking to you. I'm talking to you from the home of cycling. I'm in Mallorca, in Sóller, the home of our very good friend and joining us also on today's episode, Rob Hatch. I've come over to
always
Mallorca.
A barrel of laughs. Yeah. Always brings the fun.
It does. We had a lovely evening,
Rob. Is that right? How are you doing?
Are you sure you're thinking about the right same person here,
Rob? You had a lucky escape because it's also the anniversary today of. This dates back to the late 19th century. The world's biggest snowflake was found on this day.
And, oh, that's me.
That was nearly the intro. That was nearly the intro.
Is that what you're calling me?
Today.
No.
Yeah.
Hearing me. Yeah. Hearing me. I know I'm soft, but come on.
Yeah. Any snow in evidence in Mallorca, chaps? There can be at this time of year.
No, not at the minute. Very windy, though, actually. Sort of abnormally high temperatures at the start of the week. But very, very windy, and we saw a little bit of that in the Women's Challenge Mallorca. Quite a bit of wind affecting things early on.
And the Challenge Mallorca is the reason for Lionel's visit, is it not?
It is indeed, yes. Shall I crack on with the reason for making the winter break trip over to Mallorca? Just around about Christmas time, Daniel, I came up with an idea for a mini-series for Friends of the Podcast, the title of which came first, really. I've called it Nevermind the Balearics, which is inspired by the 1977 punk album by the Sex Pistols, which has got a very similar name. I won't say the actual name of the album. Anyone who knows already knows. Any children listening will be absolutely terribly offended by the title of that album.
Is that a rude word?
Shocking language.
Is that rude?
Well, it's rude-ish, isn't it? I mean, it might not be Premier Division rude.
Is it?
It's certainly. Is it not World Tour rude?
It's not watershed rude, is it?
I'd say it's world tour rude.
I am too naive to realise that that was rude.
Anyway.
I don't even know what it means. Anyway.
Anyway. You don't know what... I mean, we can't...
No.
Anyway, I'm here for the Challenge Mallorca, the men's race. The stage race that isn't a stage race. And I will be making a little mini-series. Rob Hatch will be popping up here and there. And anyway, it was going to be exclusively for Friends of the Podcast subscribers. But we have a new title sponsor coming on board, Sports Tours International. Our very good friends at Sports Tours International. They are kicking off their title sponsorship for the next period of the season by sponsoring my series, Nevermind the Balearics. And... it will be free for everybody from Wednesday night or Thursday morning. Five episodes, each telling the story of the race, the island, the cycling culture, history, and so on. In typical cycling podcast, kilometre zero fashion. So that's what I'm here for. I should just say the women's race already concluded. Three races, won by Lotta Hentala of EF Education Oatly, Marlon Reusser of Movistar, and Thalita de Jong of Human Powered Health, wrapped up with the race that finished in Port Dandratch, Rob, where we were for lunch yesterday. And as you say, it was mild, unseasonably mild, you were saying, but also pretty windy. And that wind has picked up today. So it could be a tough old week of racing for the men in the Challenge Mallorca. That kicks off tomorrow morning, Wednesday morning, five different races.
I forgot this about Lionel. I forgot this about your trips, Lionel. There's always lunch. Lunch is not something that really
generally, it's a nice lunch
generally
as well.
Figures when I go to bike races, but always does when you're when
not
you're
a part
in
of the island I get to visit often, actually. So it was a nice... Lionel took me for a day trip to Port d'Andratx, so it was lovely. But while we were having lunch, you're talking about that race there, I was hearing after the race, because it was before the TV coverage started, poor Mavi Garcia, who's from Marachi, just outside of Palma. She got distanced in the wind, got help from a teammate to get back on, and just a few kilometres before the race really got going at the finish, she punctured again. So not a nice day on home roads for Mavi Garcia.
And speaking of meals, Lionel, that was your contribution to this week's news buffet, wasn't it, so to speak?
It was,
this new
yeah.
revamped start of the episode, which we haven't really given a
what
name
about the,
to
the
yet.
News, but, the feed zone, the news feed zone, isn't it? Grab a musette with,
excellent.
Yeah, with two or three items in.
And then ready, steady, cook. Rob, would you like to go next?
Yeah, well, we talked about it last week in the podcast, didn't we? That Caleb Ewan, what was he going to do? Where was he going to go? No sooner had we put the microphones down, pressed stop on the record, sent all the audio, the producer had finished, it had been uploaded, and about 30 seconds later, a press release dropped.
It was almost
in it,
as though he'd been listening, or eavesdropping.
Yes, Caleb Ewan has signed a one-year contract to stay on the World Tour. He's gone to the Ineos Grenadiers. He is the only sprinter on their roster, something that Geraint Thomas had been calling out for, saying that, well, what was it? So many percent of the races finish in a sprint and we haven't got one. We could do with one. They have got one now. If you look at his palmarès down the years, one of the best. I think we said last week it's dried up a bit in terms of wins at the very top level in the last few years. But of course, 63 pro wins, plenty of Grand Tour stages, a super palmarès. Let's see if he can get back to his best.
Spare a thought for the gentleman, the rider, affectionately known on this podcast as Radio Viviani, Elia Viviani, Ineos's last sprinter, last incumbent in the sprinting department, who doesn't have a contract, does he, for next year? And we're led to believe he's contemplating retirement at this point, or possibly a role, some kind of coaching, technical role at Ineos Grenadiers. But that's a strange one because Viviani apparently wanted to carry on riding, wanted to carry on sprinting, and has not found any takers. But Ineos have said, reportedly, we believe, we'll have you, but off in an off-the-bike role. He's been moved upstairs.
A bit like when King Kenny left the Blackburn Rovers manager seat and went upstairs. It didn't end well, that.
No, Elia Viviani, of course, is saved in Ciro Scognamiglio, our good friend Ciro Scognamiglio's phone, as Sua Maestà, His Majesty, as we learned during the Giro d'Italia last year. Chaps, this week, my offering for the sort of breakfast buffet of news items, I was listening to another podcast yesterday, not the cycling podcast, a French podcast, RMC, French radio station. They do a cycling podcast. They were talking about two sort of aspiring World Tour teams of different flavours, who will be racing this year. Sorry, won't be racing this year necessarily. One of them is Unibet Tietema Rockets, and they've been in the news this year, Dutch team, because they have been invited to their first monument. They've been invited to Paris-Roubaix along with Q36.5, Tudor and Total. Now, this is a team, you may remember, was born, launched in 2019 by three YouTubers, including the former, was he a stagiaire at BMC or a fully-fledged rider, Baz Tietema.
He was on their development team. Correct. And he also rode for our good mate Sean Kelly's team for a year as well.
Unibet Tietema Rockets, they were launched in 2009. Sorry, the YouTube channel was launched in 2019. The team was launched in 2023. And it's been quite impressive how they have sort of grown both their organisation and their ambitions. As a team last year, they were Pro Continental Division. Unibet were one of their sponsors last year. Unibet have now become the main naming sponsor. Now, this is interesting. Lionel, you'll certainly remember. Unibet, of course, sponsored a team way back in the sort of mid-noughties in 2007. And that team effectively folded in 2007 because it was deemed, in various countries, I think, that a betting company shouldn't be allowed to sponsor a sports team. And that's why they were shut out of the Tour de France. And later that summer, 2007, they folded. The law has since changed in France, which also explains why this team is now racing under a French license. However, the plot thickens slightly in the sense that Unibet were taken over a few months ago by the same group as La Française des Jeux. Why is this allowed? Why are both teams allowed to compete, because there are UCI regulations forbidding effectively the same company being the title sponsor or being heavily involved with title sponsorship of two teams. Chaps, I don't really know, to be honest, and I need to investigate this further. I know there is a sort of similar situation with Cofidis and Arkea. Both, well, Cofidis are, Lionel, what are they? Loan. I don't want to use the word the S-H word.
They're a loans company, aren't they? charging quite high
company?
Interest rates.
Company.
Quite high interest rates, I think.
Yeah. And Arkea, also involved in banking, but they are both under the Crédit Mutuel umbrella, but they're both allowed to sponsor teams using some kind of, I don't know whether loophole is the right word, but the same thing I think applies to Française des Jeux and Unibet. They're different enough for the UCI to have given these two teams the green light. So they are racing this year, as I said, first Monument, still got big ambitions. They want to ride in the Tour de France one day, and they were discussing this podcast I listened to yesterday on RMC. But another team that was discussed is a team that doesn't exist yet, a nascent team called Ma Petite Entreprise, which is a French project with the backing of Vincent Lavenu, who was the team manager of Decathlon, AG2R, Casino before that. And this is a sort of crowdfunding project. You can go on their website. It already exists. Ma Petite Entreprise. You can commit anything from 750 euros to 15,000 euros. And they hope to launch a men's team and a women's team next year. Now, chaps, the team jersey, a team jersey of sorts, already exists. And it kind of looks like a page of JavaScript with thousands of tiny names, which will be the names of companies or people who have committed a little bit of money to this team. Not really very visible, but the three entrepreneurs and Vincent Lavenu, who are behind this project, think that by next year they can have a men's team and a women's team, and that by 2030 they might be able to make it into the Tour de France. But have we seen crowdfunding? Yeah. We've seen crowdfunding before on some level, haven't we?
2002, iteamnova.com was a crowdfunding team. I mean, before the internet really made crowdfunding a lot easier. It's much easier now, isn't it? But this was it was an attempt to create a team that was supported, sponsored, owned effectively by the supporters, the fans of the team. And it was a project set up by a few people, the most well-known of whom was David McKenzie, who'd ridden for the Linda McCartney team and had won a stage of the Giro d'Italia. I remember it launched to quite a fanfare. They had some success, but, you know, very, very difficult business model, and it didn't last all that long. I'm not sure they made it to the end of the season, but it was a bold idea, 23 years ahead of its time, clearly.
Jérôme Pinault, the former team manager of B&B team, was on this podcast, the RMZ podcast, and he made the good point that one of the problems with a model like this is that people who are committing money, the investors, sponsors, and some of them might just be individuals, they will all expect, or a lot of them will expect something. And it is going to be very difficult to keep everyone happy, satisfied, and make them feel invested, particularly when we're talking about that many people. Last year, the average budget in the World Tour was 32 million euros. Now, it would take 53,000 people committing, or companies committing 750 euros, which is the smallest package that I mentioned, to raise a team budget of 40 million euros, and it would take 2,666 companies committing 15,000 euros.
I mean,
euros,
they're going to have more. They're going to have the same. They're going to have more logos on the jersey than our very dear friend Gianni Savio's teams, if if my maths is correct. Yeah, I don't want to deviate into the realm of non-league English football here, but there was also a football team called Ebbsfleet United, which took the crowdfunding kind of supporter ownership model even further and allowed the people who invested in the team to have a say on choosing the team manager and selecting the squad and signing players and even picking the team occasionally. That didn't end too well either. You can have perhaps too many chefs spoiling the broth, I guess. But no, it's interesting to see another business model being approached. We'll see whether it has legs. The talk of a YouTube-inspired team, I mean, what next? TikTok? You know, just going to cycle the... They're just going to cycle the neutralised zone and then stop and do a video for social media. Be banned, of course, from competing in the US. I can see it all happening.
Cycling podcast might have a world tour team in 10 years. Who knows?
Looking ahead to the summer, or the early summer, the spring... the Giro d'Italia starting in Albania. TikTok's recently been banned there as well, I read recently. Chaps, before we conclude this part, just on sponsorship news, did you notice this morning, very good news this, in the World Tour, Intermarché have committed for another, was it 3 years, until 2028 as the main sponsor of that team, the team formerly known as Wanty Group Gobert. Now, their full name, Rob, is Intermarché.
It was Andermache Wanty Gobert, but I have a feeling that might have changed again. I'll have to delve into the notes for this year. One point to make on that, though, it is very good news because they had been one of the teams that have really been struggling with regards to the budget in the World Tour. So, very good news.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, to remind me to tell you that this episode is sponsored by Babbel, the language learning app that can help you learn a new language, whether from scratch or it can pick up where you left off. Perhaps you've got a basic foundation in another language, maybe something that you learned at school and you want to build on that. Well, Babbel will take you from wherever you are now and will improve your proficiency and confidence in speaking another language. There's 15 languages to choose from, so if you're off on holiday later this year, or perhaps you're going to one of cycling's grand tours and you want to learn a bit of Italian, French or Spanish, well, Babbel has 15 languages to choose from. And step by step, Babbel's flexible lessons will teach you meaningful phrases that you can use in real life right from the start. So you're not learning computer-generated phrases that don't really mean anything. Now, Rob and Daniel are both fluent in numerous languages. I've always been very envious of their linguistic skills, but most of us need a bit of extra help, and that's where Babbel can come in. You can fit the lessons into your daily routine and make real, meaningful progress with just 10 or 15 minutes a day. The app works on your phone, but you can also access Babbel on your computer, and the system will remember where you were, and you can keep building the blocks of your language learning. And with the voice recognition software as well, you can work on your pronunciation so you don't fall foul of the pronunciation police. Right now, Babbel is offering all Cycling Podcast listeners up to 60% off their subscription. Go to babbel.com/TCP to claim your discount. That's babbel.com/TCP for up to 60% off. This offer is valid for a limited time only. Babbel, language learning that works.
Well, chaps, the World Tour is underway. We had the Tour Down Under last week, and no mention of pre-season friendlies or the Charity Shield in last week's podcast. Well done, Lionel. Got through a whole episode, and we're not going to do it this week either. We're not going to mention it this week. In fact, it was an exciting edition. Always is. Rob's going to tell us what's happened, I think. Who won? I saw some grousing on social media about the race not being hard enough, complaints about the fact that it was decided by time bonuses. Anyway, let's find out who was the beneficiary of those time bonuses and who won the race. Rob, what happened?
Well, the time bonuses kept it going until the very least the penultimate stage, didn't it? Because the first two stages were sprints. They were won by Sam Welsford, but there was a little bit of yellow card action, wasn't there? As you've briefly mentioned last week, a couple of his lead out men given a slap on the wrist and being put into the referee's book for the first time on the World Tour this year. They were Danny van Poppel and then latterly Laurence Pithy.
Don't mention Michael Oliver.
I think it was some excellent referee in the Premier League at the weekend, apparently, somebody told me. Just don't tell Arsenal fans. Javier Romo, I'm not sure who he supports, but I can tell you that he was backing himself for the first time to get his first professional win. He rode away on stage three and he rode away, apparently, as there was a bit of confusion with radios not working or working at different times. A big, big moment for him. He pulled on the race leader's jersey as well, did the Spaniard. Remember, he's a rider who came from triathlon, spent a little bit of time at what is now XDS Astana. Day afterwards, Brian Cockar, he struggles for World Tour wins, doesn't he? But he likes Australia because he took another one. His second win at that level at this race. His first for a few years. Big win for Cofidis, who need to make sure that they get the points to stay up in the World Tour this year. The day afterwards, though, it was the day that Daniel had been talking about. Old Willunga Hill. And one Mate. Of his picks was Jonathan Narváez on debut for UAE Emirates. And Daniel, looking into your crystal ball, it was Narváez who took the victory. A brilliant win for him. A day after, it was another win for Sam Welsford. Three sprint wins for the Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe man, the Aussie taking the win. And Narváez confirming his first ever World Tour general classification victory. Not a bad start then to the season for UAE Emirates. And well, they start, they go well, and they finish well. They just can't stop winning, can they?
Daniel, you didn't just predict Jonathan Narváez, but you also, the first two names out of the hat were Narváez and Oscar Onley, who were first and second. And then I think very close behind, you mentioned Finn Fisher-Black, who got himself onto the podium overall, I believe. You joked that it was the obvious picks when I pointed this out to you on WhatsApp.
It's a bit like predicting the sun's going to set in the west this evening.
I mean, I think you're being a bit harsh on yourself there.
Lionel, in all honesty, I think that races like this that are decided, well, it was obvious that it was going to be decided on Willunga Hill, pretty obvious. There was the other day when Romo won, which we actually said last week in the podcast last week that could be a decisive day as well. But Willunga Hill is very predictable. It's a bit like the Mur de Huy. Similar, it's a little bit longer, isn't it? It's about a 7-minute effort, but it's an uphill sprint and it's pretty obvious who is going to thrive on a climb of that length. And experience is key, isn't it? We talked, I think last week, talked about timing as it is in Flèche Wallonne. And Narváez had the experience last year where he got things slightly wrong, and he obviously learned from that this year. But talking of timing, I thought maybe, I know he was happy with the podium finish, but I thought Finn Fisher-Black may have had a few regrets afterwards, and we heard from him at the end of last week's podcast. Good debut at Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe, finishing third on the final podium, but he came very late, didn't he, on Willunga Hill, and he was the fastest finisher, but he did ultimately make his move a little bit too late. And Javier Romo possibly moved too early, because he was in the Oka jersey, wasn't he? He was in the leader's jersey, and he decided, obviously, not being quite as explosive, not being as punchy as the likes of Onley, Narváez, that the best approach for him to take would be to attack from the bottom of Willunga Hill, old Willunga Hill, mate. This, I should say, we should also add, we talked last week about Ineos and their different approach, the way they were going to tackle things this year. Incidentally, chaps, I know that that was listened to with some interest by some of the top brass at Ineos. Had a bit of feedback about that. But they rode very aggressively into the bottom of Willunga Hill. They caused a split in crosswinds. They didn't come home with the bouquet. They weren't able to get the win. But Romo, when everything came back together, Romo, well, he took a flyer effectively, and he tried to strike out and win that way. But it was a very impressive ride, very impressive week by him. Rob, you mentioned his pedigree as a time trialist. He was a Spanish junior champion in that, wasn't he?
Was a good
did
triathlete.
You chaps, yeah, very good triathlete. I didn't notice any beef, is maybe an appropriate word, about his celebration for his stage win 2 days earlier, which was in the style of a bullfighter.
Well, Javier Romo, I'm just gonna caveat any chat on this. He comes from the dead centre of Spain, Castilla-La Mancha, a very traditional part of Spain. I'm not sure how much outside of his cycling he's travelled. I'm not sure, you know, whether he speaks any other languages and what other contact he's had, let's say, with cultures that might be naturally... Well, but with people that naturally are going to be critical of bullfighting, if all he's known is people talking it up.
Yeah.
Again, it's not an excuse, it's just providing a bit of context to to what where this might come from.
Yes, he's a fan of bullfighting, though. I believe. And the town that he comes from, Rob, Villafranca de los Caballeros, a few years ago, in fact, 10 years ago, it briefly made the news, not only in Spain, but across the world, because there was a vote, some kind of referendum, in which the people of Villafranca decided that instead of funding their annual bullfight, the annual town bullfight that was part of the annual town fiestas, they would give the money instead to schools, and they would buy books with it. And this was lauded as a very commendable gesture. I'm not sure what's happened since then. I'm not sure whether
they're more on board with that
now.
Than...
Yes. But Romo was very impressive though, wasn't he? One of those riders, a bit like Finn Fisher-Black. When I interviewed Finn Fisher-Black in Mallorca in January, I was really sort of struck by kind of what a fine athletic specimen he is. Very tall and lithe, and the sort of prototype, archetype of what you would hope a sort of a professional cyclist would look like. And Javier Romo is very similar, isn't he? He is a very elegant looking rider. I saw comparisons in the Spanish press with Luis Leon Sanchez, the way he took his win, and he looks vaguely similar to Luis Leon Sanchez in his riding style as well.
What about a quick word on the overall winner, Jonathan Narvaez, then? As you said, Rob, his first World Tour general classification win, unless you count the Turin Shroud classification, which World Tour status is only just around the corner, because he won the Giro stage in Turin at the very start of last year's Giro, didn't he? And the only man other than Tadej Pogacar to wear the Maglia Rosa in the Giro last year, had quite a number of years with Ineos. I think it's 5 years. Certainly his two Giro stage wins split 2020 and 2024, quite a gap between them. Has always looked like a talent, but maybe a rider who hasn't quite fulfilled his potential with Ineos Grenadiers, but did when it was a name that came up last week in relation to the Tour Down Under, and it did cross my mind that maybe somebody who had slipped the net perhaps at Ineos Grenadiers. And when your luck's out, your luck's really out, isn't it? The sort of first race in his new team colours, UAE Team Emirates, and wins the stage and the overall. Perhaps a missed or a rider that's got away for Ineos Grenadiers, but certainly making a very early impression with Team UAE Emirates. And we'll see what sort of opportunities he gets over the rest of the season, because there's a real crowded old field of riders at that team, isn't there?
Lionel, interesting you mentioned him having left Ineos. Last week, in my sort of infamous charge sheet that I put to the Ineos management, and again, there was some correspondence, has been some correspondence over the last few days about that. And that was one thing I left off, I said last week I didn't quite get to the bottom of the list. But actually, if you did list all of the riders that have left Ineos in the last few years and gone on, in most cases, in a lot of cases anyway, to better things, you know, sort of riders, particularly in the Grand Tour department, who weren't seen as the heir to Chris Froome or Egan Bernal that maybe Ineos were looking for, the likes of Carapaz, likes of Adam Yates, the likes of help me out, chaps or others, Sivakov, Dani Martinez. There are lots of them, and okay, none of those riders have gone on to become Tour de France winners or even, you know, Giro d'Italia winners. However, Ineos could have done with a few more riders like that over the last couple of years. Teo Gegenhardt is another one.
Yeah, you look at riders leaving there and going on a better. It's sort of the opposite of Quickstep, isn't it? When riders leave Quickstep and don't seem to perform as well.
The other man of the week, the fastest finisher, the sprinter Sam Welsford winning three stages as he did last year. And I think we mentioned last week that, you know, he hadn't had too many opportunities in Grand Tours. In fact, only won the 2023 Tour de France. It remains to be seen, you know, how his season will pan out. Tricky in a team like Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe. I mean, he is one of, I would say, a couple of very handy sprinters, two or three handy sprinters. But with other objectives, it will be interesting to see whether he gets a chance to be the main sprint hope in one of the three Grand Tours, especially with, obviously, Primoz Roglic having ambitions on GC. Remains very hard for a team like that to balance up those two very different types of objective and share around the team support. So Sam Welsford's got his season off to a flyer, and it will remain to be seen what his opportunities are as the season unfolds.
Any other points of interest from the Tour Down Under chaps? I mentioned those grumbles on, I saw a couple of grumbles on social media about the race being decided by bonus seconds. It seems to me that that is pretty consistent, coherent with what an early season, or the first stage race of the World Tour season should be. I don't think we've ever really had big mountains and huge time gaps in January and February at stage races. It still seems to, well, it seems to be as popular as ever, the Tour Down Under. And
yeah, I mean, what do people want? Everyone finishing on the same, being on the same time. I mean, there has to be something to split the GC. Otherwise, it's, yeah, I don't know. I think time bonuses are a perfectly valid way of making a short stage race interesting. Otherwise, I mean, what, just all ride around for a few days in the same time and just have one? I mean, what would be the material difference, really? The overall winner would still probably be the overall winner, or certainly the, you know, the handful of riders that are up there would you know, still be racing against each other. It adds another tactical dimension, doesn't it?
I saw Cyclist magazine playfully imagined what a Grand Tour of Australia would look like with 21 stages and mountain stages, which, as someone who doesn't really know Australia very well, haven't been there, not that familiar with the topography of Australia, was quite an interesting exercise. They provided the profiles of all 21 stages, a lot of sprint stages, a lot of very flat stages, a lot of hockey stick stages, very flat days with some quite sizable climbs at the end of the day, but I don't think that's something we're going to see any point soon.
One other notable from the Tour Down Under, Tom Gloag, the British rider with Team Visma Lisa bike, back in action after a really difficult couple of years. He finished eighth overall. I mean, he had a terrible incident in training when he was hit by a car in August 2023. He was out for a long while. A fractured kneecap, I think, was the most serious of his injuries from that. And then he came back and raced a bit in the middle of last summer, and then crashed in training again and fractured his elbow. So getting back to hopefully have a clear injury-free run and a decent performance overall from him, eighth overall.
Just one other thing, chaps, I was going to mention. Last week, we talked about Albert Witten Philipsen, the 18-year-old little Trek, who was very handily placed on general classification at that point. And people were hopeful, maybe, or curious to see whether he might go on to do something like Isaac Del Toro did last year in Tour Down Under, and maybe even win or certainly contend on Willunga Hill. I don't know exactly what happened on that stage, on stage five, to him. He was 19th on the stage, but my suspicion is that he got sort of caught up in the real racing that I talked about when Ineos put it in the gutter, and there was that big fight for position going into the bottom of Willunga Hill. And, you know, Lionel, you always back in the day used to talk about how there was always young talent on the horizon emerging, and at this time of year we always get very excited, particularly in the post-Pogacar era, we get very excited about emerging sort of teenagers, 18, 19, 20 year old riders. And in the speculation episode a few weeks ago, I suggested that the sort of, well, the hype around these precocious teenagers, it might be burst slightly in some cases, because
Maybe it'll go the other way. Maybe it'll go the other way. Yeah. There'll be a toddler winning a World Tour race on a little balance bike.
Well, maybe. But there has been a bit of a murmur. There have been murmurs, certainly, among riders. If you've spoken to riders over the last couple of years, in amongst the precocious talents who are going to go on to win huge races, there have been a number of pros who have been hyped as incredible talents and who have struggled really to find their feet in the World Tour, particularly with things like, mainly with things like racecraft positioning and so on and so forth. Now, I'm not suggesting that's the case with this rider, Philipson, but certainly, riding in the World Tour is different from riding at any other level, whether that's under 23 or junior racing. So it is not inevitable that we're going to see a new Pogacar or even a new Isaac del Toro every season.
Before we get our feet muddy in the final part and talk about off-road cycling, Daniel, just a mention for the first men's European road race of the season, the Clásica Valenciana 1969. First of all, Rob, do you know the significance of the 1969 in the race title? Is it the year it was founded? 41st edition? No.
It was the Trofeo Dries Puig, I think, before. I think it's changed the name a couple of times. It went off the calendar for about 15 years. There's actually a race just before that now as well, which is the Gran Premio Castellón, Ruta de la Cerámica. And that was won by Antonio Morgado of UAE Emirates, so they're off winning again. The race you're talking about, I think, was the day after, was it, the 1969 race ended in La Nucía?
Well, Luis Puig, you mentioned. I didn't realise it was the same race. My bad. He was UCI president for a long while and born in Alcudia here in Mallorca.
There you go.
Tying it all up together. But the race, anyway, was won by Mark Hirschi, getting the new season for Tudor Pro Cycling off to a flyer. I mean, that's what Mark Hirschi has been hired for, isn't it? To give them wins. He has specialised. I mean, he's got some big wins, so I don't want to damn with faint praise, but he is also, I think, a little bit of a flat track bully. I mean, he's a sort of, if he was a cricketer, he'd be totting up, you know, he'd be playing international cricket one week and then scoring 400 runs in the county game the next. He's that kind of rider, isn't he? Whether he will get the opportunity with wildcard invites to make an imprint on some monuments, we will wait and see. But he won the race. Rob, we were talking about this last night over a beer and a very fine chicken dish that you knocked up in double quick time for me. Thank you very much for that. But Astana had riders finishing 2nd, 6th and 7th. Christian Scaroni, Anton Charmig and Clément Champoussin, to be precise. And I think we can see what their strategy is whenever they can, trying to pack riders up, getting actual results and points on the board in their bid to escape relegation. And one other little curio from that race, Alessandro Pinarello, no relation to the Pinarello bike factory, bike manufacturers. He was 8th for Bardiani, riding a De Rosa. I mean, that's an interesting one, isn't it? The De Rosa marketing team must surely make something about that. You know, even Pinarello's riding one of their bikes.
Well, they'd be missing an opportunity if they didn't do it. And just to touch on that point you made about XDS Astana, the day before in that other race in Castellano I was talking about, they had 3 in the top 8. So that tactic, I think, is going to be evident throughout the year. And you can sort of see it in the signings they've made. They are going to be targeting points, not just prizes.
Oh, you've got a future as a game show host. I could definitely see that. In fact,
sparkly jacket, sparkly broadcasting jacket.
On here, she's just one thing, chaps. Well, Lionel, you mentioned wildcard invitations. I believe that his first objective of the season is going to be Strade Bianche, and then he's going to take aim at the Ardennes Classics. But with Mark Hirschi, I heard something in the off-season. I don't know whether I mentioned this on the podcast, but every time he does something in a race now, I find myself mainly wondering how he got there, because apparently, and this is not because of a fear of flying, but he has a strong preference for travelling to every race by train.
Well, he's here in Mallorca at the moment, so he clearly didn't get here by train.
Maybe he got the boat.
I tell you what, having seen the way the sea was yesterday, having seen the way the sea was yesterday in Palmer Bay when I went to meet Lionel at the airport, I really hope he didn't get the boat because it was horrible. I think he'll still be feeling sick by the time he gets on his boat, on his bike, if that's the case.
I mean, tip of the week, you would imagine he will be looking pretty lively on at least a couple of those Challenge Mallorca days, I would have thought. So, I mean, not exactly like predicting the sun will... Is it set in the west or rise in the west? I don't even know, Daniel. You'll correct me. But predicting something that's very likely to happen, I think Mark Hirschi will win one of the five Challenge Mallorca races. Tune in to Never Mind the Balearics, my mini-series, which will be, well, out tomorrow, I guess, after the first race.
And Tadej Pogacar may not have a fully established nickname yet, but Mark Hirschi will henceforth be known on this podcast as Interrail.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Sepike again. This episode is also supported by NordVPN. All of our listeners can get a great discount on a NordVPN plan at nordvpn.com/TCP. I'll put that link in the show notes. At the moment, you can get 4 extra months for free on top of a 2-year plan. There's no risk either because NordVPN offers a 30-day money-back guarantee. So that's nordvpn.com/TCP. Try it risk-free today with your 30-day money-back guarantee. Now, NordVPN, one account can be used on up to 10 devices. I've got mine activated now. While I'm here in Mallorca, I've logged on to the Wi-Fi in my hotel. I've tethered up my laptop to my phone, and I know that my internet connections are safe and secure. You can also use NordVPN to switch your virtual location so you can watch your favorite streaming services or sports events as if you were at home. So if you want to give NordVPN a try, go to nordvpn.com/TCP.
Well, chaps, it's that time of year. In previous years, we have even done, at this juncture of the season, very early on, a cyclocross episode.
Well, we did a mini-series. Do you remember, Daniel, you suddenly said, let's do the cyclocross podcast, and then you sent me to Valkenburg. I mean, I didn't go reluctantly. I loved it. It was a great weekend. But it was quite ironic that you were the instigator of this mini-series, this one-off mini-series, back in, when was that, 2018 or 19?
And that was my premiere, wasn't it, as far as cyclocross was concerned. That was the first and last cyclocross event I've ever been to.
I would have thought here we are in 2025. I thought you'd like it. You know, there's a bit of running involved. You know, does that not make it more appealing?
We don't need to alienate any more listeners, Lionel, but we are going to talk about it because one thing that I have remained consistent in, Lionel, is that I'm quite convinced that cyclocross is brilliant preparation for road racing, and we've seen evidence of that over the last few years with Van der Poel. I actually think, as we were as I was thinking about this week's episode and just thinking about the trajectory of Wout van Aert's career, I know he's continued to ride cyclocross, but and I don't have the numbers at hand, so I don't know whether this is empirically substantiated. However, it does feel as though that he has slowly moved away slightly from cyclocross over the years. He's reduced his appearances slightly. I would definitely suggest that he's reduced his sort of cyclocross specific efforts in training, and I do think he's possibly suffered as a result of that. However, we are going to see at the weekend the old dynamic duo Van der Poel and Van Aert go head-to-head in the latest edition, 2025 edition of the World Championships, which are going to be taking place in Liévin. But it's not a two-horse race, is it, chaps?
No, Michael Fantura now has just come off winning the World Cup, hasn't he? I'm trying to build it up here, and Lionel's been all realistic. Yes, Mathieu van der Poel's the favourite, and we saw him come back after what turned out to be a broken rib, actually. That injury that he'd been carrying for a few weeks, kept it quiet until revealing finally that he'd broken a rib in a crash. He'd been away training in Spain on the road, but he is on fire, isn't he? He was looking excellent and winning by a country mile at the weekend. He won yet again in Ogreda, which is his dad's event, the Grand Prix Adri van der Poel. And if, as you quite rightly say, Lionel, everything goes to plan for him, he should be able to draw level with Erik de Vlaeminck and those 7 world championship wins at the weekend. But the nice surprise of the last few days has been Wout van Aert coming out and saying, actually, I'm going to be there, I'm going to compete. And, well, when Wout van Aert's there, you just never know, do you?
The nice surprise, I thought we were going to get something else there. I thought we were going to get an expert segue there, but we'll have that in a minute.
Oh, that would have been good, wouldn't it? That would have been good. A nice surprise. Now, we'll hold the nice surprise for a few minutes. And, yeah, Matthew van der Poel, you know, he's ridden 5, won 5 in the World Cup this season. I mean, hauled himself up to 4th place in the World Cup standings. You mentioned Michael van Tuulen, who he's kind of the best of the Belgians over the course of the World Cup. But you know, when you look at his results and the way he has won the World Cup competition, it's been consistency with a couple of early wins thrown in for good measure. I mean, you know, 7th, 10th, 7th, 5th, 5th, 6th, and a couple of places on the podium. You know, he's won that title by being ever-present rather than, you know, if Matthew van der Poel had ridden and, you know, 2 or 3 more races, it would have been a much closer contest. But van der Poel's not really motivated by the World Cup title. It's the World Championships that matters. And as you mentioned, you know, Erik de Vlaeminck has had that record of 7 rainbow jerseys in the World Cyclocross, set that record between 1966 and 1973. His brother, Roger de Vlaeminck, then added a world title in 75. So the de Vlaeminck's have 8 wins. The van der Poel's, father and son, rather than brothers, have 7 wins. Adrie van der Poel, surprisingly, only won 1 world title. And it came quite late in his career as well, 1996, after a number of near misses. But Matthew van der Poel, you know, really the polar opposite. I mean, dominating cyclocross. And I do wonder, Daniel, you make the point about Wout van Aert. You know, he has faded a little bit into the background, perhaps as van der Poel has continue to sort of beat him in the biggest events. And I wonder whether, you know, he's lost a little bit of the motivation for the cyclocross each winter and thrown his focus onto
it's
the
like
road.
It's like me, but Lionel. It's like me. His motivation for cyclocross peaked a few years ago and it's dwindled slightly since then.
But yeah, you know, without wanting to sound like it's a foregone conclusion, because, you know, anything can happen in cyclocross, but it's one of those strange paradoxes, isn't it? You know, anything can happen in the sense of crash or mechanical or some kind of problem, getting caught up in traffic or what have you. The course might not necessarily suit, the weather may be a factor, all of these kind of these different things. In a way, the more obstacles there are in the way, the more the cream rises to the top in a sport like cyclocross, and that dominance, you know, that we've seen from van der Poel, not just over the 5 World Cup rounds that he's ridden this season, but also over the last number of years in the World Championships. I mean, what is it? It's 5 wins in 6 years for him. Only Tom Pidcock in 2022 has broken that run. It's dominance, and I can't see that changing at the weekend in Liège, to be honest.
You mentioned the course, Lionel. I'm sure I've asked this question of experts, cyclocross experts, before, but the course at the weekend in Hoogerheide looked like a bit of a sticky dog. It looked muddy, and van der Poel obviously won easily. Is there a feeling, and there must be a feeling, that if it's drier, I mean, I've got no idea what this course is like, Liège. It could be like a crazy golf course. It could be rock hard. What suits van der Poel? What suits van Aert? Surely that has a huge impact.
I mean, what doesn't suit them? That's the problem for everybody else.
Is that true, Rob? I mean, listen, is that true? Across, regardless of conditions, he is superior everywhere.
I think that van der Poel's skills are highly superior. I don't think there's too much doubt about that. And I think we saw that in evidence at the weekend. It was a mud bath on Saturday. It was ever so slightly less of a mud bath on Sunday. And everyone was slipping, sliding all over the place. Van der Poel seemed to glide through it, showed his skills, and he was even showboating in front of the Dutch crowd over the bridge on Sunday as well. So I think if there's any sort of difficulty or more difficulty than normal, if it's a more difficult course, then that plays into van der Poel's hands. But I mean, he's not slow, is he? So if it's a short, fast course, he's also won on those as well.
Could be 7 rainbow jerseys, 7 cyclocross rainbow jerseys for van der Poel, but he's yet to win or yet to finish on the podium of the World Wife Carrying Championship, which of course Roger de Vlaeminck did, as long time listeners of the Cycling Podcast will know.
I wonder how many of Eric de Vlaminck's wins Roger takes credit for.
I don't know. Eric, yeah. I'm sure Roger will have something to say about Mathieu van der Poel winning if he does win at the weekend. Chaps, an outsider in... I've learned so much about cyclocross in the last few minutes that I propose, and you're full of confidence after my excellent predictions for the Tour Down Under. I propose that Thibaut Nace could be an outsider for the Cyclocross World Championships at the weekend. I say that not really believing it, because I did a little bit of research before today's podcast, and Thibaut Nace, although he's one of the stars of cyclocross and has been over the last couple of years, he's European champion, Belgian champion, his build-up has been disrupted by illness or tiredness. He didn't go too well at the weekend, did he, at Hoegaarde? And he talked about not wanting to go too deep to compromise, well, for fear of compromising the World Championships at the weekend. Now, this is a rider who a lot of learned observers see as having sort of similar characteristics to Van der Poel, maybe even Van Aert. He, of course, has already raced extensively on the road for Little Trek, certainly did, certainly won a handful of races last year, including GC, Tour of Hungary, stages at Romandie, stage at the Tour de Suisse, three stages at the Tour of Poland. Just 22 years of age, the son of Lionel, someone who you are loosely connected to. Tell us about that.
Well, yeah. I was going to say, Sven Nys, his father, was the big figure of Belgian cyclocross for a long time, from sort of the, well, I guess very late 90s through to, well, relatively recently, really. I think he hung up his wheels in 2012, something like that. So quite a long career. The thing that was remarkable about him was that he would dominate World Cups and Super Prestige, but when it came to the World Championship, he always seemed to conspire to find a way to come up short, and only won the world title twice in his long career, despite winning pretty much everything else at a canter. His world titles came in 2005 and 2013. For a magazine feature a long time ago now, I spent the weekend with the Sven Nys fan club, went on a coach from the hometown in Baal, quite close over to the near the Dutch border. We went to the Kokzijde Cyclocross, which is all the way over the other side of the country. There was quite a lot of time. They were loading up the bit underneath the coach with crates and crates and crates of beers, anticipating quite a raucous afternoon out. It was a great fun trip, and I was made the honorary UK president of the Sven Nys fan club as a result. I don't know whether that passes down like some kind of hereditary title, and I'm now the honorary UK president of the Thibaut Nys fan club. But there was always talk in those years that, you know, Sven Nys and his brilliance on the cyclocross and also mountain biking might transfer over to the road. There was always speculation that he might have a go at Paris-Roubaix. He never really crossed over terribly successfully, whereas his son has got quite a solid-looking lineup of classics on the agenda this spring. It looks like he's going to race Amstel Gold, Flèche Wallonne, Liège-Bastogne-Liège, may well do Itzulia, the stage race in the Basque Country, to warm up for those Ardennes-style classics. And yeah, he's clearly a talent, not just in cyclocross, but also on the road. But whether I'm the UK president of his fan club, I suppose, I could appoint myself, couldn't I? I guess.
Well, if you are, Lionel, you might be packing your bags for a first ever Grand Tour appearance this year. There's talk that he might well even be selected for the Tour de France this year. Given the fact it could be the Grand Tour, that might suit him best. He's certainly rumoured anyway to be on his way to a Grand Tour debut. And Daniel, you talked about some of the races he won last year. 9 wins in 34 race days on the road in 2024. A sensationally consistent first big season at that level.
Well, chaps, we've talked a lot about him. Shall we meet him? Well, we're not going to meet him, but we know a man who did. Fran Reyes, our other man in Spain. He was at Little Trek Media Day on Is it the Costa Blanca, Rob? No, it's the... it's Calpe considered the Costa Blanca. It's the Costa de Valencia,
yes,
isn't
it? It is. No, it's the Costa Blanca.
Oh, it is the Costa Blanca. Fran Reyes met him just a few days ago.
I'm still figuring out myself, I think. We will really step up the game this year, riding bigger races on a higher level. Races that suit me. And now it's just about trying to... everything I did last season, now I have to bring it over to the big races and try to be ready to win over there, which will not be an easy step. Maybe this step will come next year or in 2 years, I don't know. But I will hope to just make this one. And then in the future, I will just try to be like a rider to watch on the races that suit me. Like year in, year out, I will try to be just at the top level. And this is what I... would like to achieve, and I'm not there yet, but I hope I can make this step in the next couple of years.
You say the races that suit you. What would you define to be the races that suit your abilities?
I think it's really like puncher kind of things. The way I won the race last year, something like this, maybe I can convert it to like these kind of finishes in maybe grand tours, or maybe like, yeah, flesh is a big goal for next year. So those kind of races I really want to be there all the time.
Yeah, of course. I think Wout and Mathieu are the best example. Right now they're in a completely different scenario because they achieved everything they could in cyclocross, and then it's also easier in your head to move on to the next thing. I have still a lot to prove, and I still also want to achieve a lot more in cyclocross. So because of this, cyclocross for me is still a bit more important than for them. And then it's really difficult to find the right balance. But I think the team, or like my both teams and I, are doing a super, super good job to have the combination really, really nice and everything balanced out. And for the moment, it seems to work pretty well. I mean, I had a really good road season last year, doing a really good cyclocross season again. And as long as this keeps on going, I can keep making the steps up. I feel no need to choose between one or two. Maybe in the future I will try to take it like a slightly different way, or do maybe 1 year a bit of less cyclocross to make even a bigger step to next year on the road. I mean, last couple of weeks were quite intense when it comes to racing and everything, and it's all those hours of training that you will miss in the classic season. And for this year it will be alright, because I'm not doing Flanders, I'm not doing Sanremo, not doing so I still have time to build up. But in the future, when I want to reschedule a bit again and do more classics, I will have to keep in mind to also make sure that I get the proper amount of training and a proper amount of volume in to make this step again, because it will not keep on working like this forever.
Have you ever tested yourself on long climbs or in racing?
Not really. For the moment, like, my efforts tend to be like 30 seconds to maybe 7 minutes or something like this. But yeah, I don't know, maybe I can surprise myself in the future with maybe a bit longer efforts. Also maybe on a bit of a more flat terrain or something would be interesting. But I think I can make a really big step in this in the future.
You come from a cycling family, a cycling home. Which posters did you have hanging on the walls when you were a child?
A jersey of Rafa Nadal. Mm-hmm. And that's it, actually. Yeah, I was a fan of Fabian Cancellara. And a speed skater, Sven Kramer.
How big has the influence of your father been on you and on the life that you...
Yeah, super big, of course. I cannot imagine him not being there in my whole build-up of my career. He's doing an amazing job helping me wherever he can and giving all the experience he has from all his career. It's nice. I mean, we're slowly getting to a point where he learns from me as well, which is nice. But still, I surprise myself with the amount of things he can still teach me in a good way. It's nice.
They said of your father, they nicknamed him like the cannibal from Ball. What is your preferred nickname?
For him?
No, for you.
Ah, yourself. I don't really have one for the moment. I have like the people around me, they call me Rufus.
Rufus?
Yeah.
Why?
It's like from a stupid movie, a Belgian thing. I mean, super good movie, but like nothing special. And I always used to do like the scene of the movie, you know, like to...
To pretend.
Yeah. And it was funny. And it started already from when I was quite small. And yeah, some people still call me this way. When the national coach and everything, they call me like this.
Yeah. And talking about Belgian screens, I heard from a colleague that you were followed by the Belgian TV for 2 or 3 seasons on a documentary called DNA Nice. And what was that experience?
Like, there's one more episode coming out next week. We did like one special episode now from Fast Weeks, which is nice. It's not like a full season, but only one episode. And it will be released next week. It was nice. I mean, I grew up with this kind of things, you know, so it was not like a big shock that there were cameras or people following you and talking about you or press interviewing you. So I never really knew it any other way. And like this, I mean, I never felt like it was something unnatural or something.
One last question for me. How did you get the Rafa Nadal jersey?
It's also signed and it's less to Thibaut August. Yeah. And it's from Kim Clijsters. Yeah, and she got, because we knew Kim, and then Kim knew that I was super big fan. I was playing tennis on a quite high level when I was younger. And I was in like this kind of academy where sometimes Kim was coming as well. And I don't know how or why, but yeah, she got in connection with Rafa. Yeah, for sure. She knows it. And then through this way, I got a shirt.
At what age?
It's a long time ago. It's a yellow Nike shirt. It's super nice.
What age, sorry, were you when you got the jersey?
I don't know. I really don't know. It should be around 8 to 11 years old, something like this, 11, 12. In this time frame, you know, 8 to 12 years old or something like this. And I was playing tennis on a really high level. Until it got, like from a super young age, tennis is like crazy intensive, you know. You train like I was, probably like 10 years old, and I train like 20 hours a week. Like when you get out of school, again, always to the tennis court and have the private lessons, have the group lessons, have the technique training, have the... like the physical trainings and everything and the running. And then you have the vacation of school and you just have 2 weeks at the tennis academy. And then it got so much that then one day I just said, I'm stopped. And then next Wednesday, 4 days later, I did my first cycling training with the local team. Yeah. I still play tennis quite often when I have time. I it's one of the best sports. I enjoy it so much.
Yes. I hope that you enjoyed this interview as much as you.
Well, chaps, I thought that was very nice. Nice.
Oh, I see what you did there.
Interesting as well. Rafa Nadal, the no posters on Sven Nys's bedroom wall as a teenager, but he had the Rafa Nadal jersey. Signed Rafa Nadal jersey that he acquired from Kim Clijsters. Wow. What was on your bedroom wall when you were growing up, chaps?
Henning Berg.
I think I had Kylie Minogue.
Mark Atkins.
I think I had a Kylie Minogue poster.
Oh, right.
Henning Berg.
Luther Blissett, John Barnes. Luther Blissett, John Barnes. I mean, depends when we're talking, really. And then it would have been, it would have been all sorts of Stone Roses and in spiral carpets. And anyone with kind of sort of floppy, curtainy hair playing music after that.
I've only just migrated to that phase now, as you can see looking around. There's an Oasis thing just behind you, Lionel.
Rob, on that note, I think we should tell you to bugger off. Because we're going to talk about something that has been in the cycling news today. That's January the 28th of... January the 28th. It's the 28th of January. Tuesday the 28th of January. We've had an announcement about the future of television coverage of cycling in the United Kingdom. Now, this is an issue that regards you personally. You're a little bit compromised, we thought. I'm a little bit compromised, to be honest, because I also work on television at times, talking about cycling, broadcasting on cycling. But you are particularly concerned because, well, I think, Lionel, are you going to tell us what's happened? As we say goodbye to Rob.
Well, I'm going to go and prep for my first races of the season. My commentaries begin tomorrow with Challenge Mallorca. So I'm going to go and do some work. And I hope that...
Cover your ears, lad. Cover your ears.
I will see you in a while. Nice to join
Get
you.
Get those what do you call them? Earmuffs. Is that the word?
No, they're called headphones, Daniel.
No, that's not what I meant. Anyway, Lionel.
Yeah, well, the news has been released this morning that the relationship between TV viewers in the UK and Ireland and professional cycling is going to change quite significantly this year. We've been very used to watching on Eurosport. We've been spoiled, really, with GCN, which came along and really opened the doors to showing an awful lot more coverage, particularly of smaller races, for a very good price, I would say. As you say, Daniel, you and Rob both work in broadcasting and so are compromised, but Rob especially so, and he is a freelancer for the broadcaster that we're talking about, and so felt as he is unable to speak on behalf of the company, a little bit unfair to put him in the position of appearing to speak for WBD, which is the parent company which owns the rights to the World Tour races. But long and short of it is that the cost of a Discovery Plus subscription is rising significantly, £30.99 a month. And with the news also that ITV's final year of free-to-air coverage of the Tour de France is this summer, it perhaps feels like a bit of a double whammy for quite a lot of cycling fans in Britain and Ireland. And it's caused quite a lot of controversy on social media because, of course, nobody likes to be told to pay a significant amount more for something that they've been enjoying for a lot cheaper price. So it's a tricky one because we don't know the full details yet of how the coverage is going to evolve. Certainly from my point of view, as a subscriber to TNT, I'm in a position where my circumstances will be largely unaffected because I'm already subscribing to the service in question, and the cycling will kind of migrate across to it and be encompassed within their more mainstream sports coverage alongside football and rugby and the other sports that TNT show in the UK. However, there will be a significant minority of people who are primarily cycling fans, or perhaps even only cycling fans, and so getting the football and the rugby and everything else is not of any interest to them, and so they will feel the price rise a lot more keenly. What I would say is that whilst it appears to be expensive over the course of a year, it's £13.99 a month, it's really kind of bringing cycling in line with the cost of watching other sports in the UK, and I suppose that is the unpalatable truth, which is that sports rights are expensive, sports broadcasting is expensive, and somebody has to pay the bills somehow. And I would suggest, without wanting to excuse the significant leap in price, we perhaps had it too good for too long. GCN came in and really opened the doors and made it a lot cheaper to watch an awful lot more cycling. And now I suggest maybe the jump doesn't feel great, but maybe it's just more realistic. This is what it costs to watch elite sport year round. I do think that, from Rob's point of view, he's in a very difficult situation because he's a freelancer. His living relies on working for the company, and yet he is not really a spokesman for the company. Certainly isn't his decision how much to charge a month, and so didn't really want to put him in a position with very little notice to appear to be speaking on behalf of WBD. So that's what's happened, and we'll have to see how the coverage actually evolves, and then people will decide whether it's worth paying for or not.
Yeah, I think broadening this out slightly and looking beyond cycling, we've all had this experience over the last 5, 10, 15, 20 years of something that we've previously been able to access very cheaply or for free on the internet going behind a paywall. And it is very frustrating. And it's frustrating that the systems, improvements, better systems that have been touted as solutions in the past, micropayments, for example, the idea that you could pay 20p if you just wanted to watch the Challenge Mallorca, that isn't an option. You're all in or all out. And, you know, that really, you have to go back to the sort of infancy, the genesis of the internet, and how the internet sort of en masse opted for sort of advertising funded model to find the origins of why micropayments have still in 2025 not become a thing, and paywalls are still the tool, the instrument that is being used by big media companies. And I think we've all, you know, Lionel, as consumers and also people who work in this space at various times, we have all been sort of the victims, and I suppose you could say at times also the benefactors of different attempts to circle this square this circle. And, you know, we're sort of 30 years down the line now of, well, 25 years of the internet being a huge, huge part of our lives. But, you know, we see with the number of our colleagues who have lost jobs, we've lost opportunities as well, and it has felt as though the earth has been moving under our feet the whole time, and no one has yet figured out a stable, secure way to build a platform. I mean, platform literally and sort of figuratively, for the next 15 years of how this business model of sports coverage, and whether it's written or broadcast, can work. And and that's kind of what's happening here. It's another huge company, huge group, and Warner Brothers Discovery. You know, whenever it was, a couple of years ago, the acquisition took place, and sort of GCN was absorbed. It could have looked like a good thing that such a huge group was interested in taking on board a sport like cycling. However, you know, there has been some collateral damage.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose from as a personal perspective, mourning the loss of Eurosport, I mean, it was kind of the exotic gateway into sort of deeper enjoyment and understanding of the sport. We kind of touched on this a little bit in the last couple of weeks about what does attract people to a sport like cycling. Accessibility, clearly. And so it will be really interesting to see how Warner Brothers Discovery balances up the free-to-air elements of their coverage with the subscription model. But I can certainly see, you know, the cycling fans feeling aggrieved that, you know, being treated alongside the likes of Premier League football and elite rugby and the other sports that TNT in the UK broadcast comes with a comparable price tag. But I suppose, you know, it's very easy for me to say, well, why can't they just offer a GCN-style cycling-only subscription or app or service and only watch what you want to watch? There's obviously business decisions that have made that not desirable for WBD, and I suppose that is where, you know, the strongest kind of comparison with the very recent past of GCN, which was basically the entire pro cycling scene in your pocket on your phone. This is the next step of this is not as good for the viewer and the fan of cycling as that was. And that's going to be the big hump that Warner Brothers Discovery will have to get over. They may well lose the people that only watch cycling, but their justification that they are opening cycling up to a broader audience. Maybe in time that will be found to be the case, but it's certainly not great news for cycling fans in the short term. I should just say, I mean, you know, American listeners will be listening to this saying they would love the opportunity to pay £360 a year to watch pretty much every World Tour race easily on one service. So it's all a matter of perspective as well, isn't it? I can see that. I can see why the people are upset.
Just final point, Lionel, something that occurred to me in the week, and this is maybe slightly tangential to the current talking point, but you talked last week about how a Pied Piper or the success of one individual in a particular country, as far as a sort of delivery drug, maybe in cycling, delivery drug is an unfortunate turn of phrase, but in terms of popularizing the sport, that is probably more powerful than anything, maybe even more powerful than access to broadcast, to access to live broadcast. I was reminded of this, and this week I tweeted about this yesterday. Yannick Sinner, the Italian tennis player, won the Australian Open again at the weekend, and La Gazzetta dello Sport yesterday had 19 pages. The first 19 pages were dedicated to him, and then 2 pages later on, so it was 21 pages in total. And it just really, really reminded me of what La Gazzetta used to look like circa 1998. And I was doing some research on something else the other day, and I learned that La Gazzetta's website was launched in 1998, and that year the single biggest story on their website was Marco Pantani winning the Tour de France. And in the subsequent 27 years, cycling in Italy sadly has withered greatly. And it's only tangentially linked to what we're talking about, but that is the big concern for a lot of people. The enduring popularity or interest in the UK of cycling, which of course, you know, about 10 years ago, it feels now, a bit more than 10 years ago, really touched its high watermark, its zenith, and it feels like a bit of a nadir at the moment. Anyway, on that note, Lionel, we will be back next week to talk about cycling.
Well, yes, you and I will be back next week. We will. But there's an episode to listen to every day. Short and sweet episodes from here in Mallorca covering the Challenge Mallorca. And never mind the Balearics, which will be out from, we hope, Wednesday night. If not, it'll be early Thursday morning. The first episode will debut. And that is brought to you by Sports Tours International. We're very grateful to them for their support, enabling us to make this mini-series of Kilometre Zero available to everybody to listen to for free on the regular feed. Thank you, Daniel.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.